Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11am here on BCFM 93.2. This week, the phone hacking scandal comes to Bristol. And staying on the newspaper theme, a former newspaper editor who was abused as a child has brought out a book of poetry. Fascinating to hear his story. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But I'm joined to begin with by Simon Chapman, who's a photographer, and he's also the secretary of the National Union of Journalists branch here in Bristol. And we mentioned phone hacking. Simon, you've got some event coming up in the city related to phone hacking. What is it?
Yes, we have. It's a film, One Rogue Reporter, by Richard Papiat, a former tabloid journalist, and he'll be present at the film for a question-answer session. It's at the Cube on Friday, 21st of November, 7:30pm. Tickets, £5, concessions, £7.
Now, have you had any sneak previews of this film? Because I'm just interested to hear, how does a newspaper editor go about making a film?
He's not a newspaper editor.
Oh, sorry, a reporter.
He's a former reporter for the Daily Star. Well, I'm not quite sure. He's got... I can't recall. He's teamed up with a film director who's got some sort of pedigree in making films. So, yeah, he hasn't done it all on his own.
And what's his relation then to the whole phone hacking scandal? What part did he play?
Well, it's wider than phone hacking. He was your standard tabloid hack, you know, getting up to all kinds of stunts, including serenading. Who's that singer now? I can't remember. The Susan Boyle, is it? He had to dress up in sort of costumes. He had to sort of doorstep people. And he admits that he made up stories and details of stories just to fill the paper. But one day he decided he'd had enough, and he wrote a scabrous letter to the owner of the Daily Star and the Daily Express, Richard Desmond, basically resigning, an open letter which the Guardian's published. You can still find it online. It's pretty strong. And he resigned and then became a stand-up comic for a while, went and took a show to Edinburgh. And he's kind of developed he's basically turned the tables on his former employers at the tabloids. And this film, which I've only seen a very brief bit, is where he turns the tables and sort of shows what he says the tabloids are like. And he interviews people such as Kelvin McKenzie, former editor of The Sun, and other people.
But the thing is, many people love the tabloids because they find the broadsheet newspapers, things like The Independent, The Guardian, The Times, boring.
I can understand that. I mean, not everyone likes long-form, wordy journalism. You know, it may all be very wordy, but sometimes you want a mixture of sort of punchy news, and some of it is frankly entertainment and not really news. And, you know, the tabloids are full of stuff which is fiction, really, like the lies of soap stars. But, yeah, people do like it. They sell lots of copies. The Sun is the biggest selling paper still, around 2 million copies. You know, beats The Guardian out of sight in terms of sheer sales. And yes, I mean, I personally wouldn't like to see the tabloids simply disappear. But having said that, you know, there's no excuse for sort of just making up stories which aren't true.
But if they're funny, surely that's the part of it. It's a bit like a sort of buying a cartoon book or a comic book.
But they are supposed to be newspapers. They are supposed to be fact and not fiction. I mean, you know, I'm not a prude. Gossip and about celebrities and stuff can be quite entertaining to read. You know, there's a debate to be had about how much privacy, you know, people in the public eye should have. Should they have exactly the same privacy as anyone in the public or not? But the fact is, people have always gossiped, you know, before newspapers were invented in villages, etc. And they probably always will. So I can't see gossip ending anytime soon. But the tabloids, you know, should research what they're doing and be able to back it up.
I think there's probably an argument that people who are in the public eye, actually, the journalists should be scrutinising them probably more than ordinary people that aren't, simply because the fact that they're in the public eye, often politicians, they've got power over the public. These are the people, surely, that our journalists should be scrutinising.
Well, no, absolutely. They should scrutinise their public roles, you know, to the limit. The question is how much they should scrutinise their private lives. For instance, in France, it is virtually taboo to report on a politician's private life.
But doesn't a private life reflect on someone's what someone's saying publicly? For example, they might, you know, be campaigning for you know, more marriage, for example, and steady relationships whilst having an affair on the side.
Absolutely, and I think that would be justified even under the current codes of practice which that the media have in terms of the public interest. If somebody is doing something, saying one thing in public and doing another in private, and I think there is a public interest in knowing that, and I would support that personally. If someone, you know, is a cheat and a liar in private, can you really trust them in a public role? So yeah, I would say I think it goes to the territory, and, you know, some celebrities accept it. People want to know, you know, who they're going out with at the time, whether they've fallen out of a nightclub, you know, completely drunk, etc. But there's a creeping sort of backlash to try and close down sort of reporting on private lives.
Okay, so you mentioned things like codes of practice there, but didn't we find out through phone hacking that actually the codes of practice aren't worth the paper they're written on?
Well, the codes of practice are fine. It's just enforcing them. The Press Complaints Commission has now been disbanded, no longer exists.
Because we had Leveson, didn't we?
Yes.
The Leveson inquiry after Nick Davis and other journalists really exposed this, mainly through The Guardian, but other places too, that phone hacking was going on. I mean, my own reading of that, I'm not sure if you'd agree, was that papers like the News of the World had so lost the trust of people across the country that they found that they had to actually steal their stories, that people wouldn't trust the News of the World with information because they just found the whole operation an untrustworthy one, and so the only way they could get those scoops was either to pay for them, you know, some of were officials who were bribed for them, and actually steal them off people's phones. I mean, that was definitely going on. But what's your take on how that happened, how we got to the stage where criminal acts were going on to steal information from the phones of celebrities and others?
Well, I mean, I'm a photographer, not a reporter. I've never sort of done this kind of, you know, journalism in the sense of writing stories or hacking people's phones or voicemails, to be precise. I think the main thing was it was trivially easy to do. If the default code for a voicemail password was 1234, once, you know, that got known within journalist circles, well, it was just incredibly easy. Whether some people didn't realise that it was illegal, that I just don't know. But it was just so easy to do, and if something's that easy to do, people will tend to do it. At least some of them will, anyway. I mean, the News of the World has always, you know, been a sharp operator. That end of the tabloid press, that was their raison d'etre. You know, the news of the screws. That was what they were there for, to dig out the stuff that people didn't want published. It was a finely juicy exposés, and hacking voicemails was just another tool, and it was so easy to do. They made hay for many years on it.
So why, since the police had this information that phone hacking had been going on, the police know it's a criminal offence, how come it took such a long time for them to act on it, and so many newspaper stories to persuade the police to actually stop it and to start arresting people?
I guess that's a multi-million dollar question, possibly. You know, I mean, I just don't know, but I do think the police were slack in, you know, the media has been rightly criticised for phone hacking, but they weren't the only guilty parties in the kind of mix. You know, there was a sort of chain of people selling information to the journalists, media paying for information.
Well, this is public officials as well, isn't it? Police, yeah, and people like that. Which actually, that's a criminal offence in itself.
Well, I mean, there's, you know, the often leaks, and there's a question mark as to the sort of management higher levels of the police sort of leaking stories, or, you know, not being too bothered about where certain stories came from. But when phone hacking broke, it was sort of open season on the media, particularly the tabloid end of the media. I worry that, you know, it might go too far. I mean, Richard Pepiat did give evidence to Leveson inquiries, so, you know, people can come to the event and ask him about that.
What about the balance, though, with press regulation now? I think a lot of blame was put on the press for what was going on, and actually, you know, there was certainly a lot of culpability by the police as well. But what stage are we at now with press regulation after Leveson?
Right, well, the Press Complaints Commission has been disbanded. I mean, as you say, it had lost the confidence of various sections of society in its ability to enforce the codes of conduct. I mean, the editor, there's a thing called the Editor's Code of Practice, which the Press Complaints Commission had. The new body, which has been set up somewhat in defiance of Leveson and the government, is called IPSO. And they have their own new Editor's Code Committee, except it's not really new. Virtually everybody, in fact, I think everybody on this new committee has been on the previous Editor's Code Committee, and the chairman happens to be Paul Dacre, editor-in-chief of the Daily Mail, who I think was also the chair of the previous Code Committee. So,
oh, it sounds like you've just got exactly the same organisation. They've just changed the name, almost like Windscale becoming Sellafield.
Yeah, well, that's the worry, and that is the criticism that's been levelled at IPSO by various people, including the National Union of Journalists, who don't approve of IPSO. It's not independent of the media industry. The NEJ didn't approve of the setting up press regulation under the Royal Charter either. We wanted a press model based on the Irish model, which seems to work quite well over there.
So what's the difference? Yeah, explain what's going on in Ireland.
Well, for a start, you have an NEJ representative on, you know, the Irish press board. I can't remember the precise name of it. It seems to be a good balance of official authority, media and representatives of the media. There is no NEJ representation on IPSO at all. The NEJ has long fought, you know, to have representation on the Editors' Code Committee and within the Press Complaints Commission, but was always fobbed off. There is a rival body called Impress, which the NEJ is supporting, which hasn't quite got as far down the road of being established as IPSO. But
why should the National Union of Journalists be on that committee? What's the NEJ got to offer?
Well, we've got our own code of practice for NEJ, which all NEJ members agree to when they join the union. And, you know, we have an ethics council. The NEJ campaigns for ethical journalism and for standards.
Plus,
as we represent working journalists rather than editors and managers, it seems sensible to have workers' representation on the press regulatory body.
Well, another sort of person that I would expect to be part of some kind of press regulation body are the sort of people who've become the victims of the press over the years. I'm thinking of people like Chris Jeffries, famously involved in the Joanna Yates murder case, who it seems the Avon and Somerset Police press office had some communication with some of the national newspapers, yeah. And his name came out as we've got our man kind of thing, and then it was subsequently shown it was nothing to do with him. Yeah. So what about Chris Jeffries? This is a homegrown Bristol story here. Have you come across his point of view?
I've certainly come across his point of view. In fact, he's spoken at least one Bristol NUJ event that we had at the Arnolfini. We have a series of lectures, which this Richard Pepiat film every year is this year's Ben Lectures, we call it, named after Tony Benn, who gave the first lecture in our series some years ago. It's an interesting point to sort of have, and I suspect that there will be kind of certainly sort of public figures on Impress. I'm not sure about IPSO.
And I wonder, because I'm just thinking about this now, thinking of Chris Jeffries, wouldn't it actually be quite an incentive on the newspapers not to bash somebody publicly, and also maybe press offices as well, if they thought that ultimately that person might end up as a press regulator? I mean, that seems to me to be a pretty good incentive not to overstep the mark for the newspapers.
Well, it's an interesting idea, but I would be wary of certain victims, as one might put it, being on a press regulatory body. And I think of Max Mosley and Hugh Grant. People are sort of really pushing Hacked Off as a sort of major thing. In fact, I do believe that's one of my slight qualms about Impress is that they are funded in part by a trust connected with the Mosleys.
So what was Hugh, is there a connection between Hugh Grant and Max Mosley?
Well, only in that they, I think both, I think, I'm not totally sure about this, both being involved in Hacked Off. They both gave evidence at Leveson. They're the sort of public figureheads against the tabloid media. I can't really bring myself to have a lot of sympathy with either of them. They both got caught, in inverted commas, with their trousers down, and they're both public figures. And
this is the danger, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, of course, people who have been actually outed, maybe famous people, influential people, who've had stories written in the press that they don't like, can then become campaigners for press regulation.
Well, this is what we've got to be so, so careful of. I mean, the famous saying about the press is that news is something that someone somewhere does not want published. It's always going to be the case that, you know, certain stories people don't want published. But, I mean, if you never publish a story because someone didn't like it, you just wouldn't have a free press. And above all, I think we need to keep a free press. I mean, the current chair of Ipso, I think Sir Alan Moses, it's just been quoted as saying that he wants an unruly press, a press which is free and unruly. And I kind of sympathise with that. I mean, looking back through English British history, there's a sort of tradition of irreverence towards the powers that be. I mean, you think of sort of Hogarth's satire and other stuff, you know, even back in the 18th century. And I wouldn't want to lose that aspect of the British media.
What about Bristol, though? Who owns our press, and how healthy do you think it is?
Well, it's not that healthy in that, you know, the ownership of the press is far too concentrated. That's another thing the NEJ has long been campaigning on. I mean, most of the print media, as you know, the Post, well, actually, the ownership has changed a bit. The Bristol Post, Western Daily Press, etc., are owned by Local World. They used to be owned by the Daily Mail pretty much wholesale. However, Local World is a consortium of the Daily Mail. Trinity Mirror, interestingly, publishes the Daily Mirror, who one would think are arch rivals of the Mail. And another company, I forget, which publish magazines. The Daily Mail has about a third of a stake in Local World. So anyway, that covers most of the mainstream regional print daily papers. Interesting though, Bristol 24/7 has kind of resurrected a monthly magazine in a joint venture with the former publisher of Venue, Dougal Templeton.
Ah, right, because Venue actually used to do a bit of journalism itself, and it was almost like a bit of a counterweight to the old Evening Post.
It was indeed.
And then it went under, so you're saying it's starting to surface again?
Yes, it has. And I think the tone of Bristol 24/7 has changed quite recently to be much more critical of, say, the mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, than perhaps it was before. I've noticed a change, I think, in the last few weeks. It's an interesting, as we know, listeners don't, you know, Bristol 24/7 was started by a former Western Daily Press journalist, Chris Brown, and he ran it as a web-only operation for several years. He's now teamed up with, they've expanded, they now seem to have some staff, and Dougal Templeton has come on board. He set up Venue, he sold it to the Evening Post some years ago, which I think some people at Venue thought was a crying shame, but some recompense. He's helped set up a print version of Bristol 24/7, which comes out once a month in addition to the website. So that's independent of the Post.
Well, what difference does it make then if the Bristol Post has got competition? Do you think it sort of hones their game a little bit more, and are they likely to maybe become a bit too much a part of the Bristol establishment otherwise?
I don't know. There's always I would certainly hope it, you know, the more competition there is, apart from the fact of sort of pushing people to sort of try and cut corners, which is not a good thing, but the more competition there is, hopefully the more it does hone, you know, one's practice, as it were.
Does it make a difference to have this new player in the scene in Bristol, Bristol 24/7? I wonder if you think it's going to actually up the game in the city to mean that that the Bristol Post starts not to be quite so part of the establishment as it seems to be. And I wonder what it's like in a city where you've actually only got one outlet, and to actually have more outlets has surely got to be a good thing.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, there's always a slight problem though with the local paper. They're kind of there both to sort of champion the city as a whole, as in the population and the whole of the city, rather than the powers that be in the city, and to sort of be critical. So it's easy to accuse local papers of sort of bigging up the establishment and business. But on the other hand, if they were always critical of the city, one would think, well, what are you trying to do? You know, so in some ways, local papers can never get it right. They can never please all the people all the time.
Do you come across any of this as a photographer? Do you still work as a news photographer?
I do.
So do you ever come across, well, you know, you think there's a good story there and the story doesn't appear, or that sort of thing?
Sometimes stories just don't appear because they haven't got space, and as I'm a freelance photographer, they don't want to pay. That's the biggest reason, you know, stuff I submit doesn't get used. It's got to be something that, all kinds of things happen. It might be a busy news day, etc.
I mean, what's happened with photography at the Evening Post, the Bristol Post? Have they cut down on photographers?
Yes, they have.
Yeah?
Yes.
And is that probably the same sort of thing going on in other parts of the country?
It is countrywide, it has to be said. In fact, it's been pretty dire in recent months. Staff photographers have been laid off from Scotland down to the southwest. It has to be said that Local World made redundant the last few staff photographers at the Western Daily Press and the Gloucestershire Echo and Citizen. That happened this summer.
How can a paper like the Western Daily Press survive with no staff photographers?
Because they use freelancers, including some of their former staff who are immediately started freelancing. This is Local World management, and this came, I do think this actually came from the top rather than regionally, because I was quite involved in this as an NUJ rep. But I mean, they gave them a really horrible choice. They said, you can either, you know, your staff, you're entitled to statutory redundancy, so you can either have your redundancy, but you can't freelance for us for 12 months. Or you can effectively resign, not have any redundancy money, and you can start freelancing for us immediately. For people that hadn't been working there very long, their redundancy package was not enough to sort of tide them over for a couple of months, let alone 12. So some of them were faced with a terrible choice, really.
And when you end up, actually, on what is effectively a kind of 0 hours contract, where you may not get any work.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you could do. In practice, for instance, the photographers at the Bristol Post were given a much better settlement a couple of years ago, and they are freelancing regularly, you know, doing several days a week, you know, enough to keep them ticking over. I don't think it's as much money as when you're employed. And it also happened at Johnston Press in Scotland. In fact, Johnston Press has been laying off photographers in Scotland and the North. And now they're starting to do it in the south as well. Portsmouth Echo is the latest one. Others, I mean, in fact, paradoxically, the only staff photographers left in this region are on some of the sort of small weeklies, I think, perhaps like the South Gloucestershire Gazette or something like that.
Well, I look at the Bristol Post sometimes and I think, well, hang on a minute, quite a lot of the photographs that are in there are just being sent in for free by the readers.
Not that many. That has been a concern. Most of those photographs in the Bristol Post are by professionals. Yes, you get readers' pictures, particularly on the letters page, and you've always had that for years. The Western Daily Press does a bit more in terms of the spread of readers' pictures, particularly sort of scenic, rural things, sort of harvests or landscapes, etc. The Bristol Post doesn't use that many readers' picks, and I hope, you know, they keep using professional pictures, because it takes some skill to sort of condense, you know, what is needed in the image into one picture, and to make it have visual impacts.
Okay, just remind us when this Richard Pepiat film, One Rogue Reporter, is on, Simon.
It's Friday the 21st of November, 7:30 p.m. at the Cube, which is in Dove Street South.
It's just around the back of King's Square, isn't it? Off Jamaica Street.
Yes, it is in the lower Kingsdown area, sort of very quite close to the BRI and Stokes Croft. It's BS28JD if you want a postcode reference. Tickets are £7 on the night, or £5 concessions and for any J members. It's cash only, and if you're not a Cube member, you do have to pay a £1 lifetime membership fee. But then you're a Cube member after that.
Okay, and just remind us again the date and time.
21st of November, Friday at 7:30 p.m.
Okay, Simon Chapman from the National Union of Journalists in Bristol, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
A poem from The Hill called September Song. Boots and bottles and a telescope reel, no one knows just how I feel. Sitting blindly by a Catherine wheel, I open my arms to you. Write me a song to sing all day long, catch me a tune to howl at the moon. Watch me waltz on a silver spoon, I open my arms to you. My golden daughter does what she ought to, reading medical books with whiskey and water. The words get longer but never shorter, I open my arms to you. The breakdown came, the breakdown went, 44 years they were paid and spent. I'll pack up my shoes and buy a new tent, I open my arms to you. The sun still warms the September air, the grass is green and the day is fair. I look at my life with barely a care, I open my arms to you. The fox will run and the bat does fly, the poacher stares at the empty sky. Time it passes with no reason to cry, I open my arms to you. That was From the Hill by Nick Outerside.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And now the book is called The Hill. It's by Nick Otterside, Songs and Poems of Darkness and Light. And in order to talk about it, I'm joined by Angela Balassi. Hi, Angela. I'll hand over to you and let you have a chat to Nick.
Thank you, Tony. Yes, tonight I'll be joined by my former news editor turned author, Nick Outerside. Nick is an award-winning newspaper editor who left journalism after 28 years in the industry, following a nervous breakdown. He has gone on to write his first book of poetry as part of his recovery, called The Hill, Songs and Poems of Darkness and Light. In it, he covers his issues such as childhood sexual abuse, cancer and bereavement. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Angela. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You?
Very well indeed, thanks.
Good. Could you tell me a little bit more about your book and how it came about?
Oh, crumbs. The book was a complete accident. I never envisaged myself as a poet. I scribbled some poetry down when I was a teenager, maybe, and certainly never ever saw myself as a published poet. It came about a year ago, just over a year ago, 15 months ago, I suffered what, for all intents and purposes, was a nervous breakdown. And part of the recovery process prescribed by my doctor was to start talking through and writing down, if possible, some of the issues which led to the breakdown. I began a blog, which can be still seen on www.seagullnick.wordpress.com, and started to chart the events of my life which led to that breakdown. When I got writer's block, or just the whim sort of attached itself to me, I started to write one or two things as poems. And gradually the poetry started to grow, and I think it must have been about this time last year, I had about 10,000 hits on the blog and about 100 followers, and all of the positive spin on my blog, the positive feedback, was all about my poems, which I found absolutely gobsmacking. And over a period of probably 2 or 3 months, coming through to about February of this year, people were sort of saying to me, some complete strangers, Nick, you ought to publish this as a book. And that thought had never crossed my mind. And anyway, here it is. The book was published last week, and 1,000 print run to start with, and it's selling well, and fingers crossed, but it's certainly part of the recovery.
Well done. Could you tell me a little bit more about the breakdown itself, how it showed itself?
Oh, my goodness. I'd had a lot of things befall me in my life, probably maybe more than average, and I'd sort of a little bit of counselling on the way and attempted to deal with them as best I could. And I think at the end of the day, it was the string that broke, or the straw that broke the camel's back. And June the 16th last year, I was in the newsroom like any other day. A few things had happened to trigger the breakdown, and suddenly I found myself 8:30 in the morning crying my eyes out, running for the door. I got home and my poor wife found me sitting in an armchair in the living room staring at the wall, and that's about all I can remember of the actual day of the breakdown. But it was sudden and totally unexpected.
If I understand correctly, it partly stemmed from your childhood sexual abuse. Is that right?
I think it probably started, yes, it started and ended there. If you want me to go into a little bit of detail about the events which led up to the breakdown, I mean, I was sexually abused at the age of 14 into the age of 15 by a Scout district commissioner in the area where I lived in the south of England. It coloured my entire life. Everything which followed, looked back on that. And I suffered numerous relationship breakdowns as a result of that. I questioned my own sexuality to start with. I couldn't form any bonds with anybody, least of all partners, and went through two divorces and a number of breakups with other people close to me. And it would have been about 90, well, it was November 1990, I was talking to someone for the very, very first time about the abuse. So this is like 20 years after it happened. The abuse happened in 1970, 1971. And they gave me the courage to report it. And I was living in Scotland at the time, and I went along to my local police station and made a formal complaint. I said, look, this man did this to me, and I know to other boys as well. And they took it very seriously. And the inspector interviewed me, said, look, Nick, we'll look into this. We'll have to liaise with the police force in the area where it happened. And he said, we'll get back to you. And 2 weeks passed. At the time, I was editing a newspaper in the west of Scotland. And I had a phone call to go back into the police station. And the inspector sat me down. And he said, I'm afraid it's some bad news. Your abuser is dead. He died a few years ago. And that's the information we have from the other police force. At the time, I know I took it very badly. I was very angry, I think. I was 24 years younger than I am now, and I was just livid. I thought, how can this man have escaped and done this to me, and I know to other boys? And he's just died. And I got on with life, and it didn't help what had happened. I still went through relationship and friendship breakdowns and all the anger that pursued me all of my life, and which resulted in things like alcoholism and so forth. And then a year and a half ago, I was working at my last newspaper. I've been editing there for 8 years and been dealing with a number of child sex abusers in our area, and was searching on jeansreunited.com for some information about this particular sex abuser, which I found very quickly, and I was amazed at this website. And I thought, I wonder what I can find about my abuser's own death and his family. And I couldn't find anything initially. There's nothing in the 1980s about him at all in the area where I lived. And I widened my search a little bit, and bingo, I found he died in 1996, a whole 6 years after the police told me he was dead. That led to all sorts of thoughts. Was this a cover-up? Was it just a complete cock-up by the police? And that stewed on me for 2 or 3 weeks, and then a very minor thing happened in the newsroom, and that was the breakdown.
Hmm. I mean, can you tell us about the abuser now? Can you tell us about the situation?
He was a young middle-aged man. I was 14. He would have been about 40, I think, from memory, looking at the date of his death and how old he was then. He was the district commissioner for scouting in the area where I lived. I'd been in scouts since I was 7 years old as a wolf cub. And he gathered a coterie of boys around him. I was one of them. And I finally managed to get out of it by, he'd called a patrol leader's meeting at his house in the town. And after about an hour of the meeting, I found myself and one other boy called Brian with the only two left. And I remember this day, both of us looking at each other, absolutely panic-stricken. We're in his house on our own this time. And we both just ran for the door. And we ran into the night. Mm. And my father eventually found me in his car. This is long before the days of mobile phones. I'd had to ring home. And I remember getting absolutely hammered by my parents for how dare I run away from this nice man's house, and how worried they were about me. But I never could tell them. And my dad died 6 years ago, and he died not knowing.
Why was it you couldn't tell anybody at the time?
Oh, all manner of things, mainly guilt. The guilt and the shame that I think lots of teenagers go through. You know, crikey, if this man has done this to me, I must be, in those days, we used the word a puff. I must be a puff. I must be gay, you know. After all, I let him do it to me. And that then deepened, and once that was embedded in me, I couldn't break that. And I went away to university, and like a lot of boys at 18 years old, I tried to bed every girl I could find to prove to myself I was not queer. And I'm sorry, I'm using the language of the time. Mm. My mind was all over the place. And as I said to you a few minutes ago, I mean, it then impacted on every aspect of my life which followed.
And how did he put you in that situation? What was his, form of manipulation?
Initially, shame. He caught me with other boys in our tent. I won't go into any sort of details of what 13, 14-year-olds do when they're on scout camp, but initially shame, and then what would happen if your parents knew, and then secret, and then, you are part of this. And just imagine how horrifying. This is 1970. Relationships with parents were very different back then. My dad and I only became close when I was in my 30s or 40s. We did not have the same levels of communication that kids have with their parents these days, on the whole.
Based on your experience, would you have any advice for the current government inquiries?
We need to be totally transparent. They need to dig a lot deeper. I've seen some of the stuff that's come out this week regarding the fact that these are so-called files into child sexual abuse in the 70s and 80s have gone missing. I don't believe that for one instance. As a journalist, I was given certain names of former cabinet ministers 24 years ago, and I've kept those names in my head, and those names are only just starting to come out now. I think that it needs to be total transparency. Whether we'll get it, I really genuinely don't know. But there are a lot of people in very senior positions in this country, in the establishment, the judiciary, the police, the government. Forget about the so-called pop stars and DJs. That's just the froth on the surface. It's a lot more, I believe, as a journalist and as an abuse victim, a lot more sinister than that.
Who do you think should be running the inquiry?
We need to find somebody totally independent of the establishment, but somebody who's also respected. I mean, Michael Mansfield's name has been suggested. Somebody like him, who is seen as independent from all sides, although I'm sure the Conservative government would not necessarily see him as that. Somebody who is devoid of any former inquiries. I lived for 8 years in North Wales, and there's an ongoing inquiry there into the abuse which happened in children's homes in North Wales.
Okay. Do you think there has been improvements, though? That there is more transparency?
I think only by default. I don't think the government of any shade has gone out and sought to improve things. I think it's only been by public pressure and the likes of abuse victims and one or two very, very good MPs who have actually stood up and raised the questions in the House of Commons that we're actually getting anywhere now. I mean, my abuse was 44 years ago, but, you know, you look at the Jimmy Savile cases, they go back to the 50s and 60s. This has been going on for one hell of a long time. And there have been some very, very powerful people, including former prime ministers, who knew and then did nothing. There's a wonderful interview, it's available on the internet, of a former Tory chief whip who talked about it openly in an interview with the BBC back in the 1990s. It stinks.
As a newspaper editor, if you knew the names at the time, were you unable to print them? Why weren't they printed?
Unable to print them for lack of burden of proof. Mm. I've a number of friends who are former, unfortunately, a number of friends who are former and late MPs. I mean, two I can name. One is Margaret Ewing, the former SNP MP. And the other is Bill Hodgson, a Tory MP. And both of them talked about this. I mean, Bill particularly, and Bill named names. He went beyond, this is going back to 1990, he went beyond the names of Harvey Proctor, who had been convicted of certain crimes. and said, look, these other people are involved along with him. And one of them at the time was a cabinet minister. And that cabinet minister in the early 90s suddenly was no longer a cabinet minister because the pressure was being put to bear.
Do you think these people will ever be brought to justice?
I think a little bit like Nazi war criminals. I think time's running out on a lot of them. A lot of them are into their 80s and that now. Whether they will end up like my abuser did, dying before they're brought to justice, I genuinely don't know. I hope so. I hope so. Just not for anybody else, but for the victims.
And for yourself, you've made it public, you've written about it. How has this helped you?
Oh, I've called him in the last year my demon. It's enabled me to exercise that demon. Some of it is in the poetry, in the book. A lot of it is written at great length on my blog. And I've talked about him and what he did, but also about how it impacts on people's lives. One of the things that makes me a little bit angry now, I hear people try and deflect away from some of these court cases. Oh, it happened a long time ago. Why should we be bringing these old men to justice now? What they don't seem to realise is the paradox, which is the longer it goes on, the greater the harm to the victims. It literally ruins complete lives.
Okay, and can you tell us how people can order your book?
Well, sure. The quickest and easiest way is to go onto my website, which is www.writeahead, that's all one word, writeahead.co.uk. That's writeahead.co.uk, and they'll see a section on the website where it gives details of how to order the book.
Nick, could you please share your blog address as well?
The blog, yes, certainly. www.seagullnick, that's seagullnic.wordpress.com.
Okay, thank you, Nick.
Thank you very much indeed, Angela.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, he's been our featured speaker for the last couple of months. When we get the chance to, he's on here. We have here now the latest excerpt from a speech in Berkeley, California from 1962 called The Ultimate Revolution. The guy doing the talking is Aldous Huxley. He's a British thinker and writer. And he wrote the book you probably heard of, and there was a film made of it too, called Brave New World. And he actually had a bit of a dispute with George Orwell, the author of 1984. In a most friendly way, actually. He was saying, well, in 1984, the idea that's depicted there of a future society is actually rather an obvious way of controlling the population. Aldous Huxley said it would be much more subtle than that, with things like secretly drugging the population through the water supply and that kind of thing. So let's go back to 1962 now and his talk, The Ultimate Revolution. Aldous Huxley.
These new substances, this is really very extraordinary. That a number of these new mind-changing substances can produce enormous revolutions within the mental side of our being and yet do almost nothing to the physiological side. I mean, you can have an enormous revolution, for example, with LSD-25 or with the newly synthesized drug psilocybin, which is the active principle of the Mexican sacred mushroom. You can have this enormous mental revolution with no more physiological revolution than you would get from drinking two cocktails. And this is really a most extraordinary effect. And it is, of course, true that pharmacologists are producing a great many wonder drugs where the cure is almost worse than the disease. Every new edition of medical textbooks contains a longer and longer chapter on what are called iatrogenic diseases, that is to say, diseases caused by doctors. And this is quite true, that many of the wonder drugs are extremely dangerous. I mean, they can produce extraordinary effects, and in critical conditions they should certainly be used, but they should be used with the utmost caution. But there is evidently a whole class of drugs affecting the central nervous system which can produce enormous changes in sedation, in euphoria, in energizing the whole mental process. without doing any perceptible harm to the body. And in this sense, this represents, it seems to me, the most extraordinary revolution, that in the hands of a dictator, these substances of one kind or another could be used in the most with complete first of all with complete harmlessness, and the result would be that you can imagine a euphoric which would make people thoroughly happy even in the most abominable circumstances. These things are possible. This is the extraordinary thing. After all, this has even been true with the crude old drugs. As a houseman years ago remarked, apropos of Milton's Paradise Lost, he says, "And beer does more than Milton can to justify God's ways to men." And beer is, of course, an extremely crude drug compared with these ones. And you can certainly say that some of the psychic energizers and the new hallucinants can do incomparably more than Milton and all the theologians combined could possibly do to make the terrifying mystery of our existence seem more tolerable than it does. So that here, I think, one has an enormous area in which the ultimate revolution could function very well indeed. An area in which a great deal of control could be used by, not through terror, but through making life seem much more enjoyable than it normally does. Enjoyable to the point where, as I've said before, human beings come to love a state of things which, by any reasonable and decent human standard, they ought not to love. And this, I think, is perfectly possible. Well, then, very briefly, let me speak about one of the more recent developments of in the sphere of neurology, the implantation of electrodes in the brain. This, of course, has been done on a large scale in animals, and in a few cases it's been done in hopeless in cases of the hopelessly insane. And it is, anybody who's watched the behavior of rats with electrodes planted in different centers must come away from this experience with the most extraordinary doubts about what on earth is in store for us if ever this is got hold of by a dictator. If I saw not long ago some rats in Magoon's laboratory at UCLA. There were two sets of them, one with electrodes planted in a pleasure center. And these rats were, the technique was that they had a bar which they pressed and which turned on a very small current for a short space of time, which we had a wire connected with their electrode, and which stimulated this pleasure center, which was evidently absolutely ecstatic, because these rats were pressing the bar 18,000 times a day. apparently, if you kept them from pressing the bar for a day, they would press the bar 36,000 times on the following day and would fall till they fell down in complete exhaustion. And they would neither eat nor be interested in the opposite sex and would just go on pressing this bar. Then the most extraordinary rats were those where the electrode was planted halfway between a pleasure and a pain center, and where evidently the result was a kind of mixture of the most wonderful ecstasy and being on the rack at the same time. And you would see the rat sort of looking at its bar and sort of saying, to be or not to be, that is the question. And finally would approach and do it, and then it would go back with this awful, if one can humanize or anthropomorphize, he was feeling something terribly mixed, and he would wait for quite a long time before pressing the bar again, but he would always press it again. This was the the extraordinary thing. And I notice in this most recent issue of the Scientific American, there's a very interesting article on electrodes in the brains of chickens, where the technique is very ingenious. You sink into their brains a little socket with a screw on it, and the electrode then can be screwed deeper and deeper into the brain stem, and you can test at any moment, according to the depth, which goes in fractions of a millimeter, of what you're stimulating. And these creatures are not merely stimulated by wire. They are fitted with a miniaturized radio receiver weighing less than an ounce, which is attached to them, so that they can be communicated with at a distance. I mean, they can run about in the barnyard, and you can press the button, and this particular area of the brain to which the electrode has been screwed down to will be stimulated, and you will get these fantastic phenomena that a sleepy chicken will suddenly get up and rush about, or an active chicken will suddenly sit down and go to sleep, or a hen will suddenly start sitting as though it were hatching out an egg, or a rooster will start fighting, or will suddenly go into a state of extreme depression. The whole picture of the absolute control of the drives is terrifying. And in the cases, the few cases in which this has been done with very sick human beings, the effects are evidently very remarkable too. I was talking last summer in England to Gray Walter, who is the most eminent exponent of the electroencephalogram techniques in England, and he was telling me that he's seen hopeless inmates of asylums with these things in their heads, and that these people were suffering from the uncontrollable depression, and they'd had the electrodes inserted into something resembling, evidently, the pleasure center of the rat. Anyhow, when they felt too bad, they just pressed a button, the battery in their pocket, and he said the result was fantastic. The mouth would go down, would suddenly turn up, and they would evidently feel, for I don't know for how long at a time, very cheerful and happy. So that here again one sees the most extraordinary, revolutionary techniques which are now available to us.
That was Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, speaking about a year before he died, back in 1962, about the ultimate revolution. And we'll have more from him in future weeks. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Simon Chapman and Nick Outerside, and also to the interviewer, Angela Balassi, also, of course, studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
He was banished to the moon because she stole the pill of immortality from her husband. You might also look for her companion, a large Chinese rabbit, who is easy to spot since he is always standing on his hind feet in the shade of a cinnamon tree. The name of the rabbit is not reported.
am I going to play the extraordinarily saucy end of this record? I may be daft, but I'm not that daft. That's Julian of the Clan Liberator with DDR, A&E Department, the rabbit's name was... on Stay Up Forever Records.